Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is May 2nd, 2019. This is episode 136. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast. I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Matthew Naylor.
Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Hello, it's good to be here.
You're on a different podcast.
I am. I'm on two, in fact. I am normally podcasting with you on the Cambie Report, and I thought that I would stop by as Scott is out
gallivanting across Europe.
Yeah, in the Low Countries. I also do Spirits of the Law, which is a podcast for those who are called to the bar, both legal, politics, and liquor reviews. So check those out.
Today, we're here to talk about the Nanaimo Ladysmith by-election, the gas wars, the labor law reforms that are going through the legislature, and just some random other stuff that comes up.
Exciting. I love random other stuff. It's one of my favorite collections of stuff.
Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Well, let's talk about the federal election practice run, because that's basically all it is. The Nanaimo Ladysmith by-election's happening on May 6th, next week. And I don't think anyone has really talked or thought about it since it was announced.
I'm a little skeptical of whether it's a practice run, safer than the idea that the political parties get to get their machines out and, like, work out some of the kinks because they haven't been in constant campaign mode because it hasn't been minority parliaments forever. Like, I remember during the minority parliaments period when every couple months there was an election scare, and so they were ready and there was training for partisans and that kind of thing. But basically, the political machinery for every major party has not been activated since 2015.
Yeah, there have been a few little by-elections here and there. Like Jagmeet Singh's was a somewhat important one for the NDP. But other than that, they've all been kind of trivial, like little seats here and there. Not for the voters in those ridings, of course.
No, nor really for, like, Jagmeet, certainly, because that was very much a make-or-break moment for his leadership. So, who are the candidates?
So, the Greens are, who I'll start with first, they're running Paul Manley, who's running again after he ran in the previous election. So, people maybe know him in the constituency.
Oh, no. Jennifer Clark's running for the People's Party.
Yeah, she was a school board candidate who ran on the anti-Soji platform that a bunch were running around on.
Whenever things like that rear their ugly head, I do tend to pay attention, and Jennifer Clark has been a standard bearer for everything that is bad about society. So hopefully they don't do as well as they did in Burnaby, which was a kind of horrifyingly
that
high amount.
Yeah,
which hopefully the Westminster system is a little better at resisting populist appeals and the slow erosion of democratic norms, but
Or it just forces them into the Conservative Party, who are running John Hurst, who I think is just a local businessman. I don't know too much about most of the candidates running there. The Liberals are running Michelle Corfield, and the NDP had their nomination race a couple weeks ago, as they all did, I guess. And they're running Bob Chamberlain, who's the past vice president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, and I think has had a relatively prominent role at the provincial scene in the past as well.
So the riding projections from 338canada.com show a relatively tight race. That is, however, based entirely on, like, the projections from the last election forward, plus the shifts in the national
I think they have
scene.
The provincial vote
okay.
factored into there, but there have been no riding-level polls.
Yeah.
Which, even if you do one, they tend to be bad.
Yeah.
Because they're hard.
I mean, they don't... Well, they could be hard. We just don't spend enough money on polls because there isn't enough money in politics in Canada to allow for scientifically accurate polling to exist at a riding level, which is probably all in all a good thing, but does leave us with a little bit of a problem for, you know, prognosticators like ourselves.
If you go off those very rough numbers, though, from the provincial level. It looks like it's a it's a four-way race, but the Greens projection is in the range of 27%. The NDP is around the range of 26%. These are with error bars of like 5%, so could be either. The Conservative and Liberals are both also sitting around 23%. So in the last election, the NDP got 33% of the vote there and won the riding. It was the lowest percentage win for the NDP in BC in 2015. Like Sheila Malcolmson did the worst of the winners.
And I know that the Liberals really see this as a potential for a pickup. Like the Liberal Party has been busing people over from Vancouver for the last couple of weekends to try and get out the vote. So we'll see what Trudeau's machine is able to manage. But it's also not been a super great time in the media for Trudeau.
For many reasons.
Yeah.
Well, so that area around Nanaimo has traditionally swung, depending which part of Nanaimo you're in, between Conservatives and NDP.
It's one of the Blorange ridings.
Yeah. So the Conservatives, I think, are hoping they have a shot. The Greens have been doing well there. I think Adam Olson's riding is in the area, and some of them represent that area as well. So
it's also, Nanaimo has been changing. Nanaimo's been growing as a city, and it is becoming more urban, and certainly that is the kind of riding that the Liberals want to target.
So it's going to be a turnout.
Yeah,
it's a by-election, right? So all you need to do is make sure that the people who voted for you in the last election come out again. And if you do that more effectively, you win.
If you can get the same people to come out for a by-election as showed up in the general, you will win. However, given that by-elections typically see, you know, up to half or more percent fall off from the voter turnout in a general election, good luck.
And that's one spot where I think the Greens might struggle on one hand. I don't know that the federal Green Party has the same infrastructure as any of the others. On the other hand, they're not doing much right now, and there are three Green MLAs there who are probably eager to see a federal MP elected. Elizabeth May has her team in Victoria already, so she can send them up a bit north.
The island is also the place where the Greens see a huge potential for pickups, so I can imagine them trying to get it. Also, this is the time for smaller parties to try and make pickups. Unfortunately, it's not like a super representative or predictive indicator for the federal election, so I'd be surprised if this vote tells us much about what's going to happen this fall.
Yeah, even in Nanaimo Ladysmith, it'll most likely just be the same cast of candidates running in October.
Yeah, with entirely different results.
Yeah. So with that, do you have any prediction for it, or are we just going to go, it's too much of a toss-up?
Yeah, it's too much of a toss-up. I don't know. Basically, if I had a D4, I'd roll it and see whoever. It's going to be ground game, so I'm going to say NDP hold.
I think I agree just in the fact that having the incumbency advantage, it's not an incumbent, but
yeah,
having the existing party infrastructure.
Like a riding association, don't underestimate the power of a good riding association, and there's nothing that creates a good riding association than winning, unless of course you're an Albertan Liberal, in which case losing forever creates very strong riding associations, but that's not necessarily the case here.
Well, you have to have your drinking club.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to talk about the battle at the pumps. I've avoided talking on this podcast about how expensive gas is, but as it's like the third or fourth week the province has been complaining about it, I feel like it's finally time to talk the politics of gas prices.
So, there are two sides to this, and I am basically just furious with everyone because no one has come up with a smart or salient policy around this. John Horgan certainly didn't cover himself in glory either in the past when he was railing against high gas prices during the Campbell and Clark administrations, nor has he right now with his very, very silly proposal to build a refinery.
So we're likely to see gas go to $2 a liter this summer. And on the one hand, that's kind of what the point of carbon taxes and things like that is. The world is burning, people are using too much fossil fuels, and we want to make it expensive to discourage them from doing it. But apparently it's going too fast here in BC.
Well, you don't have a a concrete industry person on anymore, but as someone who has to drive a lot for work, I can tell you that it is annoying. It is very annoying, and I understand that we're about to live through an apocalypse, and so the fact that I have to drive is a small bit of pain that I simply have to bear, but it does worry somewhat because high gas prices were the thing that triggered yellow vest protests in France, and I'm really reticent to promote anything that might trigger the Nazis from coming back.
Fair point. That went a different direction than I expected, but no, it is valid that for a lot of people, switching to transit or other options isn't actually an option yet. You know, if you live in a suburb and you've been there and you can't afford to move, you can't afford the time it takes to transit, driving is your only option. And so it is an affordability crisis.
This is where there is like a huge disconnect between like the gas tax rebates that people can get and are accessible to people, because I think people just see that as part of the general tax refund and not as a specific give back from the gas prices that they're paying. I don't think that people really put those two in the same silo. So I'm very skeptical of the ability, unless you like listed it on the receipt. If you file, this is what you might get. It is rough because like chief amongst the Gorgons of this particular issue is Andrew Wilkinson, the leader of the BC Liberals, who has opened him up to criticism for both left-wing and right-wing reasons. And I say left-wing, but I really mean people who are in favor of a planet that can support human life, which I suppose is, I guess, a left-wing position, but should also be a right-wing one.
I've seen too much U.S. politics talk about people who have, like, a stronger climate policy being more left on climate, and I'm like, can't they just be more pro-climate? And that sounds very Green Party-esque, but we should want all our parties to have a climate change strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, so like believing in climate change is one thing, and it really should be a prerequisite for involvement in politics at all.
But I think we have a good situation in BC where at least the major parties do accept the reality of climate change, and it's just what they're going to do about it. And so when it comes to gas here and gas prices, Andrew Wilkinson's laid out a number of possible solutions, and I think the first one you're alluding to on this undermining our climate policy would be slashing the carbon tax.
Yeah, slashing the carbon tax or the gas tax or, you know, any of the things that I think actually are good right-wing positions, which is to say using coercive tax policy to change people's behavior on an individual level rather than mandating something from above. The other one that I thought was really dumb was price fixing, which is just so incredibly boneheaded, I shudder to think.
Well,
that
it's a position Horgan had is on record of having advocated in the past, and now he just says those were his more naive days. And when asked about this, he has pointed to, I think it's Nova Scotia, I want to say, one of the Maritime provinces does actually have a regulatory body that looks at gas prices on a weekly base.
Like a BC Utilities Commission
type
thing?
Okay. And they basically say, this is the maximum you can increase gas this week. And it's just like, I don't know, Saturday at 11:55, there's always queues at the gas stations. But Horgan says the studies on those show it's not been super effective, although their gas is cheaper than ours right now, as is everyone's.
Our gas is expensive because, one, we need a high gas tax to keep the air in the Fraser Valley breathable. Two, we have a number of supply issues that are probably a nice segue into our next topic, because pipelines are a thing, and there used to be a pipeline that supplied quite a bit of refined gas to British Columbia, and that now seems to hold quite a bit of dilbit.
This is, of course, the Trans Mountain pipeline that used to be owned by Kinder Morgan and is now owned by every one of us.
Yep.
There's a lot of talk of twinning it, of course, and that's what the controversy has been for the last several years. And the claim was never that twinning it would mean cheaper fuel for people in Vancouver, because the goal was always to take diluted bitumen from the oil sands and get it to China.
Yeah, and that being what it is, there was an agreement to send quite a bit of refined gas to BC through that pipeline originally. The fact that our refining capacity in the Lower Mainland has gone down substantially, I think we have 4 functioning refineries at one point and now have none? One?
There might be one in Burnaby still.
But suffice it to say, the refining capacity in BC actually ends up being largely dependent on Cherry Point down in Washington. So there are structural problems, and unfortunately for John Horgan, refineries take a little while to build, so it's not really going to affect anything before, like, he couldn't get it built before the next election, no. Let alone tomorrow, which it's a short-term problem. This is the thing that annoys me so much, is that, like, there's literally nothing that can be done other than price fixing, which is a bad idea.
It's a short-term solution.
Yeah, but it's also a short-term solution that, like, won't help anything.
Yeah, it'll just create massive shortages.
And it also, as a crass political operative, it's not going to help anything before the next election for anyone involved. Like, if you're going to do something that is effectively, you know, standing on the rooftop and throwing out dollar bills to people, do it right before an election and otherwise let market forces take their...
I mean, we're in a minority parliament. They can force an election whenever they want. But I think one possible, and it's not a short-term solution, but one possible thing that should be done is maybe not quite the price-fixing level, but getting the BCUC to do a bit more inquiry into what I think anecdotally every driver feels like is oligopolist practices of every gas company. Because when you drive down the street and everyone raises their prices at the same hour, you go, is that legit?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any way to break a cartel like this.
We could nationalize them all, or at least just one of them.
Yeah, that definitely would make Alberta so pleased.
I think Alberta owned a gas company at one point, or oil company. That was Lougheed, but those were different days.
Yeah, for sure. And I know Petro-Can was another Lougheed era creation, though certainly not one that Lougheed himself. Sorry, I'm saying Lougheed, and it's Lougheed.
But,
man, we've been out here too long.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say, the premier seems to have taken up the torch of the erstwhile Premier Lougheed, but changed the direction of the quote. Actually, this was Klein, wasn't it? And instead of the Eastern bastards freezing in the dark, it's the Western bastards freezing in the dark, because the turn off the taps legislation has passed in Alberta.
Well, it had passed before, and it was in a weird nether region where the legislature had voted third reading in favor of it, but the bill hadn't been given royal assent.
That was before the last election, or?
Yeah. So the Notley government passed the bill and then left it idle.
They just didn't send it to the LG is off.
Yeah. And the reason Rachel Notley gives for that now is because she knew as soon as it gets enacted by the LG, BC is going to file a constitutional challenge against it and it can be heard. Because BC did file a constitutional challenge against it and the court went, well, the law's not enacted, so come back to us later. And now Kenny has proclaimed the law, or more accurately, the LG of Alberta, who I cannot name off the top of my head.
The last LG of Alberta that I remember was Lois Hull, but...
I don't believe it's her still.
No, I'm pretty sure she's dead.
So the law's been proclaimed, but Kenny has now said he's not going to use it yet. He just wants to have that threat to stop the gas from going to BC, and BC has now filed a constitutional challenge against this law.
Man, it makes you wish for the heady days of the wine war. But in terms of, petty, silly actions that the Kenny government is considering taking, my favorite among all of them is the Rat Patrol.
I think I mentioned this briefly once before, and Scott was perplexed by the fact Alberta has a Rat Patrol at all.
Oh, yeah.
And let alone that Kenny would threaten to use it maliciously to interrupt trade.
Well, the Rat Patrol has typically only patrolled a very thin swath of Alberta between the Saskatchewan border and just inwards of that. The Badlands of Montana and the large farms there don't allow rats to cross. The north doesn't allow rats to cross, and rats don't really like mountains. So Alberta is safe, save for the potential infestations coming from the east. However, the Rat Patrol, or Jason Kenney's trade chalk troops, might be inspecting every truck coming from BC in basically a move to piss people off.
It would work.
It would work.
And it might be constitutional?
It almost certainly is, I think.
Whereas some of these other measures seem less so.
Yeah. I think that it would probably be constitutional to turn off the TAPS legislation if it blocked exports everywhere, but probably not exclusively to BC. Makes you really happy that they all signed that new agreement on internal trade thing a couple of years ago.
Well, the other possible trade interruption is BC is still waiting to hear what the provincial Supreme Court thinks of proposed changes to BC environmental assessments, where we could turn off the taps from our end if we think the product coming through could be damaging to our environment.
Yeah.
We could both be turning off the taps on both ends and go, no one gets any oil.
No one gets any oil anywhere. And yeah, we can freeze in the dark and Alberta can drown under a sea of dilbit. So, hooray, we are all acting like mature adults.
Well, in a way they actually are. All of this nonsense aside, Kenney and Horgan, since Kenney's election, have actually met several times, it sounds like, or spoken on the phone. And all of the reports out of it are that they're being very cordial, very polite. It's going very well, maybe? I don't know that they're getting anywhere. But they're putting on a weirdly positive face.
I kind of had this fantasy of, like, them meeting and then just getting along famously. Like, kind of like how Obama and John Boehner got along really, really well. Not that that actually managed to achieve anything, but I can just imagine, you know, some buddy-buddy relationship between Kenney and Horgan, even though they disagree on everything. Like, some kind of Western odd couple as part of the Council of the Federation.
So I don't know where this all goes. I guess we're waiting to see what the federal election turns out. We're waiting. I know the federal government's approval for the Trans Mountain Pipeline has been pushed into June, and Amarjeet Sohi has even hinted that maybe they'll put off making a decision until after the election, which is bonkers.
No, don't do that.
I don't know how that's better than, like, anything else.
I feel like the Liberal Party of Canada lost all the people that they were going to lose when they bought the pipeline. Like, that ship has very much sailed because it had access to Tidewater. Like, failing to approve the pipeline or delaying it for some reason, especially a political-looking reason, would, like, jeopardize even more of the potential for a Liberal re-election campaign. Also, just seems like bad public policy. If the consultations are done and the review is ready, approve the pipeline again, the one that you approved before.
They might still be doing a bit more on consultations, is the one delay.
Yeah, that's fair. And if consultations are indeed the sticking point, they should take the time to do it right, because you can't be forced back by the federal courts to the drawing board again. That would just be a very silly embarrassment.
In the meantime, we all keep paying a lot of money for gasoline and have to keep talking about it.
Do we fucking ever? But I need more local accused criminals and fewer out in, like, Abbotsford, just as a proportion of my overall day. Or if people could, like, coordinate their crimes so that they could all appear on one day and I don't have to make trips all the time.
There's a letter to David Eby to see if he can coordinate the justice schedule around you.
Yeah, I'm sure that will take the Attorney General's office by storm.
Well, let's move on and talk about how you don't get to hire children to do jobs anymore in BC.
Well, if the legislation passes, there are two bills that have been introduced, Bill 8 and Bill 30, two labor reforms Bill 8 is one that was introduced just on Monday, I believe.
And Bill 30 was like yesterday.
Yeah. So these would raise the minimum employment age to 16, which is in concert with UN guidelines, with exceptions for 14 and 15-year-olds to do light work. So basically, paper routes are still going to be fine, apparently. I mean, to the extent that there are still paper routes.
Yeah, it's little things like that. I think like mopping floors or little things. But what was being reported is there were cases where you were allowed to work as young as 12, I think. And in some cases, children were working in factories and more serious industry jobs that they probably should not have been for many, many reasons. And the UN Commission on the Rights of the Child, which is one of the many declarations the UN has passed and Canada has in theory signed on to, but we kind of look this way and that on many of the provisions, as every country does on many of UN provisions. And BC is finally catching up with that. And this seems like one of those announcements that everyone is like, wait, that wasn't already the case?
I mean, like, I had my first job when I was 15 years old. And I don't know, I think I was okay to work then, but I was working as a cashier. So I think that probably falls into the category of light work. I'm not sure, I haven't read the act, but I mean, farm work appears to still be considered light work, so.
The reason for that is, I grew up on a farm, and you will get the sort of family farm approach where you're old enough to help out a bit, and I don't want to go to jail because I had my kid help some work. And it gets tricky because I do think we do need better labor protections for farmers and farm worker kids, and Rachel Notley got raked over the coals for
that.
Oh,
yeah, she did, yes.
But it's important stuff.
In addition to that, there are some additional leave provisions, 36 weeks of unpaid leave for a critically ill child, 16 weeks of unpaid leave for a critically ill adult family member, an additional week off for those experiencing domestic violence, because apparently domestic violence is the equivalent of a critically ill adult family member plus 1 week.
I think the way it works, the domestic violence one, I'd have to look into a little bit more, but it talks about how it can be split. So if you're in a situation where I think you need like a few days here or there, you won't lose your job. Essentially, all these provisions just say you can't be fired if you need to take time off to look after a child, to look after a family member, or to frankly look after yourself.
Yeah, and certainly I think that for women escaping domestic violence, the absolute last thing that they need is also to lose their job, but I find the numbers kind of unusual.
I know there was a labor code review that led into both of these bills, and I think the recommendations were largely adopted, and that's where these numbers came from.
The one that I found particularly interesting is the new law that says that employers can't steal tips, which I thought would have been part of the law already, but who knows?
They're banning a very specific way that employers were doing it, because in a lot of restaurants, they'll do tip pooling and then divide it out, but often maybe like keep a bit for management or people who aren't necessarily collecting it.
Oh, okay. It's a tip outs thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they're restricting the rules around there to make sure the people being tipped get to keep that. Or if they do pay out the dishwashers and the kitchen staff, that's fine, but it's not like managers get it too.
Right. So this is when the amount collected exceeds the cash receipts or the receipts for an establishment, all that money has to go to non-salary, non-management workers.
Something like that, yeah. Because I guess that was an issue in some restaurants. And for people who are making server wages or other minimum wages, that can be a serious hit on your income.
Oh, yeah. And tipping is definitely something that can move a server from like making less than minimum wage, basically, to having like a very stable income. But it's something that is entirely dependent on your employer not stealing your money.
Yeah.
And now that is illegal. So good on the government for that.
There's another related to that, sort of. The government's also looking to extend the time that you can recover owed wages from 6 to 12 months. I think this is if you lose your job and need to fight to get money you're owed back, you don't have to do it very quickly. You can get your life in order And this I think mirrors how the Human Rights Commission bill also extended the time to file a human rights complaint from 6 to 12 months, because sometimes when you lose your job or have a human rights thing affect you, it takes a while to get all of your stuff in order, and having a little bit more time can always help.
Bill 30 is one of those interesting ones for me, because it highlights one of the biggest differences between the Greens and the NDP, because there's nothing that raises the ire of some of my NDP partisan friends than the Green Party's opposition to unions, or like perceived opposition to unions. Harry Baines says that if the NDP had their majority, they would have had a card check, which is a way that a union can be certified when you just get enough people to sign their union cards saying, I want a union. And when a certain percentage of a class, of a workforce, signs those cards, the union pops into existence, rather than having a secret ballot vote, which is a more challenging way to create a unionized labor force.
Yeah, the union perspective on the issue with secret ballots, because everyone, I think, has the intuitive secret ballots are more democratic. The union criticism of that is employers really hate unions, or really hate the idea of their employees becoming unionized, because it just makes business harder in most cases. So there will often be a don't certify campaign from the employer, which can put a lot of pressure on employees, and they prefer the card check because it works out easier for them, because they can kind of push it through and not have to do this extra round where maybe the employer is like, if you vote to certify, we're going to fire you all.
Yeah.
Which they can't exactly do, but they can...
They can kind of do it. Yeah, it's very possible. And given that a lot of people aren't super up on the provisions in the Employment Standards Act, it's actually a lot easier to do than I think a lot of people would think, at least in terms of the actual practice of it, which is why, you know, I very much stake my claim to being one of the most pro-union BC liberals out there. I think card checks are probably a good idea. They are less democratic. Like, don't get me wrong. They are definitely less democratic than having a secret ballot. But also, I think that they are a better way of ensuring workers are protected and share in the benefits of the commerce that they are enabling through their labors.
And of course, employers claim that card checks, in that situation, the big labor bosses are going to be like threatening other employees to join, which when I heard that, I was a little confused by the power imbalances. I mean, there are situations where there are big evil union bosses, but most of the time it's the boss that has the power in that situation.
Yes and no. I mean, the big unions did have a lot more power in BC 30 years ago, and that was in part because of this card check legislation. It might be one of those things where I'm perfectly happy to see the policy swing back and forth as, you know, the labor market and employment market shift. But it's, you know, I think probably a good thing that as the economy probably heads towards a recession next year. Certainly the U.S. economy is heading towards a recession, and I'm not going to break any news here, but the Canadian economy often follows the U.S. economy.
For some reason, it's almost like we're
one
most
big
major
integrated
trading partner.
Yeah.
So Andrew Weaver really didn't want card check, and it seemed like if the NDP tried to call that bluff, that this bill would not have made it through. And the NDP wants to do a bunch of changes to the labor code because it sounds like they haven't been touched since before the internet.
Yeah, that probably has introduced some changes to the labor market.
So the one thing they did do to try to move a little bit more away from the employer lobbying regime of the secret vote is to shorten the amount of time that it takes to get the vote done. It used to be 10 days, and after this bill passes, it'll have to be done within 5 days to just try to get it through quicker, so there's less time to campaign, I guess.
Also, how exactly are they going to be banning anti-union campaigns while supposedly protecting employer free speech?
I literally don't know. That's just what the government is claiming this bill will do. I think they're allowing the employer to talk about the issue, but you can't just say union's bad or something.
That's definitely a restriction on free speech.
Oh, yeah, it is a restriction. So whether that one will last remains to be seen.
Well, we've always been at war with Oceania.
I think the other good thing
that... Or East Asia. What is it? Yeah. Anyway, 1984.
The one thing I know unions are excited about in here is this successorship protection and the expansions on that. So if a company gets bought out and all the workers have a certain contract with the employer, that contract now has to transfer to the new employer, even if they're subdividing things out. So you can't just have your unionized company working in a certain way and just go, well, we're just going to sell over here and break up your contracts, fire you all and hire you all back.
Yeah, that sounds like probably a good thing. I think that like a disappointing part of this is that while there is an expert panel that continues to study the gig economy and other forms of precarious work, there hasn't been any action on it. And certainly while there's like not a big Uber market right now, I think some of the most marginalized employees are definitely food couriers and the on-demand courier market. And as a former bike courier, I have a particular soft spot for a group of people that get shit on by employers all the time.
We're both millennials. We know so many people who work just on contract basis as opposed to employer. And you get shifted around so much, you may not have work suddenly. And solving that dramatic change in the economy over the last couple of years is a tricky, difficult situation that I don't know anywhere in North America has really solved yet.
No, and I think it was New York recently where Uber drivers recently voted to unionize. So I think there might actually be some kind of movement towards some kind of reform there. But until the government finally gets around to like studying and actually introducing some legislation on ride hailing, something that I am growing in opposition to as things kind of demonstrate how the need that ride hailing is going to be taking away from is actually public transit. Like the mode share is going to be shifting from public transit. And Uber themselves have said our primary competitor is public transit and not
cabs.
Yeah, that's a problem.
But
just
yeah.
Make public transit better. People will stop complaining.
That'll solve our gas prices too. Not quickly. And no, it won't.
Yeah. No, gas prices need to be incredibly high, and also we need to stop using gas cars.
But what's interesting with both of these bills is you have the first NDP government in 15, 16 years, as they keep telling us, introducing their first changes to the labor code, and they aren't the big, scary union, Burnaby, NDP changes that I think anyone feared, and maybe that's just a testament to the fact it's a minority parliament with the Greens holding that balance of power.
That's definitely going to be the BC Liberal argument, which is don't give the NDP a minority, look at what they've done already, ooh, ooh, scary, ooh, ooh, no. But I'm sure, of course, the next campaign will be conducted with the incredible tact and high-minded political discourse that has always characterized BC politics.
Well, luckily on this, it sounds like all the parties are mostly supportive. The biggest criticism the Liberals have had is that, and it's probably a fair criticism, a lot of rules and details remain to be seen when they get hashed out in regulations, which is just the trend in Canadian governments, it seems.
Yeah, it's actually interesting for me because, like, I went to law school in Australia, and in general, Australian legislation is written with a lot of stuff in it that would in Canada be part of regulation. And so we do way more legislating through order and council and the creation of regulations than our Commonwealth brethren do. My personal belief is that it does make our legislation quite a bit cleaner, but also I think makes it much more difficult for the average person to understand legislation and regulation in Canada. And in a system where ignorance of the law is no excuse for not following the law, unlike apparently U.S. campaign finance law, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of unfair. Then again, I also had to go to law school in Australia and deal with like the Australian Social Securities Act, which is a monstrous hydra of a legislation that is... like very, very dense. And of course, no layperson could understand that either. It's funny that you bring this up today because I have TimeHop on my phone, and I was part of something called newting in Australia, which was a negotiation equivalent of moot court. So it was negotiating outcomes on time, and it kind of creates these mock negotiation sessions. And I was part of this state level competition team, and a bunch of regulations that I'd written on a whiteboard all came up in my TimeHop today, and they were very dense, and like the wording was just very Byzantine. So legislative drafting is as much an art as a science, and making people aware of what their rights are, what the laws are, is certainly going to be an ongoing challenge as society gets complex.
Well, and just to, I guess, close off on our discussion on these labor reforms, that brings me almost back to one other one that we sort of skipped over, which I wasn't going to bring up, but in terms of helping people out, one of the changes Bill 8 is doing is modernizing the Employment Standards Branch. And one thing the BC Liberals had done was create a, quote, self-help kit in there, so I guess people could try to solve their own labor issues.
In lieu of actually being able to unionize.
Well, the NDP are killing that kit and instead going to give more money to the branch to hire more staff and have all the complaints go essentially straight to the director to consider. On the one hand, that sounds bad because it will be more bureaucratic and slower. But on the other hand, if you have a legit complaint but don't know how the system works and the self-help kit maybe wasn't good, you at least get someone qualified to look it over. I think that's going to have to be hashed out and seen whether, like, I don't know enough about this to know whether this is a good change or not, but I can see challenges coming.
I mean, the self-help kit was very much a way to reduce employer expenses for having to contest things under the ESB. Whether or not it is a good way for individuals to try and resolve problems with their employer, I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical of forcing everything into the ESB as a complaint process. I'm more in favor of a mandatory mediation type approach, but
just as long as we don't put more things in the Civil Resolution Tribunal.
I mean,
that's a separate episode.
Yeah, yes, it is. But you know, I'm interested in seeing how that looks and if there is going to be some kind of corresponding increase in funding or resourcing for people to access the ESB. Because there is a big, I think, mental hurdle for people to jump from, I have this problem with my employer, to, I am filing a complaint with the government.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether or not self-help was the best way to do that, I don't know. But, I mean, at least there was a way. Like, at least there was a toolkit.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still more labor reforms to come, and we'll have to see what those look like when they drop.
Yeah, and if John Horgan wins a majority in the upcoming election, probably cart checks, apparently.
Let's jump into quick takes. You wanted to talk about the fundraising numbers that have been posted for the first quarter of 2019.
Yeah, so Elections BC released their quarter one fundraising numbers. The BC Liberals led the pack at $832,000 and change. The NDP not far behind at $720,000. The BC Greens at $118,000. Not $118. That would be dismal.
Interesting to see the Liberals take the lead again. I think the NDP was leading last year after they had brought in the per-person limits on fundraising. Both parties are getting about the same amount in the per-vote subsidy, so they're still neck and neck for fundraising. And the Greens seem to be slipping. I think they might have been doing better before. They weren't in the same realm as the two main. 118 is still a great amount of money for them.
Yeah, and aside from the fact that in the recent Nanaimo by-election, they spent like a huge amount of money per vote and saw their vote share collapse, especially in a region where they kind of expected or hoped to see some traction for their policy. And certainly that one had the added tension of being, will the government fall or not? it's an interesting thing to consider. But the, you know, I think there has been some kind of discussion on whether or not the BC Liberals would be able to survive the transition to the new funding formula. And I think this pretty resoundingly says, yeah, they'll be fine.
I think the one thing that's still outstanding is, aside from the money coming in, the underlying financial situation is still significantly better for the NDP, as Patrick has pointed out, partially because of how much the Liberals spent on fighting
the existential threat to their political party. And yeah, sure, the NDP does have quite a bit of money in the bank compared to the BC Liberals, which I think are probably still in debt, but or maybe they have climbed out of it just with this quarter of fundraising,
because I think
their debt was around $1 million. And I know that according to one particular BC Liberal Party apparatchik, they have reached $1 million in fundraising this year by April 30th, which isn't quarter one, but is still a pretty hefty chunk of change for a provincial political party in a province of this size.
Well, those parties might need that money. They won't, but they might need that money if two new recall campaigns are successful.
Ugh, they're not going to be.
No.
It's basically impossible to have a recall campaign, but Maple Ridge, the Cauldron of Fury, has launched two recall campaigns. Maple Ridge remains a battleground. It's one of the, like, weirdly tight ridings. I'm always surprised to see Maple Ridge, like, in the, oh, yeah, there was a 17-vote march in a recent election. But the two MLA recall campaigns against Lisa Baer and Bob Deeth.
Yeah.
Reports of 600 volunteers. Whoop-de-frickin-do.
So the campaigns haven't officially been launched yet. I think they're thinking they might launch them in the next 30 days. But as I think I've done with the claimed recalls against David Eby or Daryl Plekis, you generally need, well, the law is you need 40% of the registered voters to sign a petition. And given you get a turnout of about 60% and you get barely that many people combined voting for the two major parties, you need serious discontent before anyone can be threatened.
And to my knowledge, neither Lisa nor Bob has eaten a baby on live television, which is, I think, the kind of thing that would have to happen or YouTube, I guess.
Well, there is a point in this local news article that residents have gotten tens of thousands of people or 10,000 people to sign petitions about the temporary modular homes the province is putting into their neighborhood because, you know, they hate the homeless that much out in Maple Ridge.
On the plus side, once they have a temporary modular home, they're not homeless anymore.
Mm. But split those angry people across two ridings and it gets twice as hard to reach their thresholds of roughly 17,000 signatures each. So no recalls are coming, but it's a nice distraction.
Yeah. From, of course, the BC Liberal Bozo eruptions, which mercifully are not coming as part of a campaign, but Lori Thronis, the Chilliwack MLA.
He's also the child care critic, and he's in the news now because he has claimed, well, the BC NDP shouldn't be pushing us so fast towards universal child care because we already have that. One parent can just stay home.
Because, of course, every family has a two-parent household.
And
fucking asshole.
And the ability for, and the financial capacity for one person to stay home, even if.
Yeah, like that.
It's wrong on so many levels.
Like, there were a number of things, but, like, the thing that stood out to me initially is just, like, not everyone has two parents.
Yeah.
It's just so tone deaf and,
well,
so,
and you know when he,
like,
says one parent
normalizing.
Can,
like, it's so normalist.
Yeah. When he says one parent can stay home, you know who he's talking about. He's not talking about one of the men in the same-sex relationship.
Yeah, I was.
He's usually talking about the woman, I'm going to assume. So.
Yeah.
His defense, and he hasn't backed down on this, is he's of the, I want families to be able to raise their kids their ways. Maybe the charitable approach to that would be the Harper, give families money to go to whatever childcare or do whatever they want with. The uncharitable is you just read the things he says and think about them.
Well, apparently you can not only travel, you know, a couple hundred kilometers east, you can travel 50 years back in time. But then, of course, rates of unionization were much higher. So regular people working the jobs that cannot support a family today would have been able to, on a single income, support that family.
But Thronus doesn't take Bozo of the Week for the BC Liberals.
No, he does not.
As Rich Coleman decided to start talking about the agricultural land reform bill that's going through that the Liberals are going apoplectic about, and I still haven't really understood why, but his rough quote in the debates today was, "I find it difficult to talk to this bill because I've been here for 23 years and I've never seen a more bigoted piece of legislation come before this House. This is a province that has used multiple pieces of legislation to ban Chinese, Indigenous, and other
people." In fairness, he wasn't in the House for those.
All right.
But go on.
He goes on to say, you know, particularly on a day like today, and he's referring to Holocaust Memorial Day, which was honored in other parts of the House. He says, on a day like today, when we witness people whose rights were taken away from them in the 1940s.
Okay.
Which is also...
Number one, it's not historically accurate, the rights of people in Nazi Germany, which is assuming what he is referring to, were taken away in the 1930s. If he's talking about Japanese internment, those rights were taken away in the 1940s, and I suppose that is bad and doesn't sound like what he was referencing, because he was saying, on a day like today, Holocaust Memorial Day. I mean, certainly... BC should be more aware of the massive historical crime that it perpetrated against people of Japanese descent here. And I certainly think that Rich Coleman should be aware of that, because he was the House leader at the time that the apology to Japanese Canadians was introduced in the House, i.e. the person who gave it the okay.
To his credit, he did tweet this evening, "This afternoon, I spoke to a bill that I feel erodes the rights of farmers. Because of the emotions of today, I drew an analogy that was insensitive. I apologize to anyone who took offense."
"I apologize to everyone who took offense" is, it's such a weak
apology. It's not
quite,
"I'm sorry you're offended."
Yeah.
It's a bit better than that.
It's a little better. It's one step above.
I mean, it's Twitter, so it's not going to be a perfect apology, but you can, like, screenshot a little statement or something.
Do better. Do better, or I'm quitting the party. Like... not just you, Rich Coleman. You too, Andrew Wilkinson. You too, all the caucus. The only one that I'm particularly pleased right now with is Linda Larson, who introduced an amendment to the Interpretation Act. Let's end on a high note.
Yes.
So, the Time Amendment Act is before the House. Washington State recently, under the hashtag legislation, ditched the switch.
That's much trendier than anything we've had.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really good. But they recently passed some legislation that says that they will end standard time, basically, that move to daylight savings time on a permanent basis. California also has had that legislation pass their houses. Oregon has some stuff working through the legislature there. And BC has a private member's bill,
which, as we know, tend to go nowhere.
Nope.
Almost
nowhere at all.
With the exception of Andrew Weaver's B Corp bill, which has gone to second reading for the second time, and it sounds like people are talking about it actually passing, which would be one of the first private members' bills to really pass in BC. Like, one of the first substantive ones. There have been one or two other in a while.
Yeah, and I've taken a look at the Benefit Corporation Act, and it doesn't actually seem like it amends the Business Corporations Act any more than would be applicable for the community contribution companies, which is an interesting form of incorporation that no one knows about at all. The BC Liberals introduced it to much fanfare, and then it quickly faded into obscurity.
But time changes. This is, I think, the second or third time that this private members' bill has been brought forward. I think last time it was brought forward, John Horgan was quoted as saying, "I'm kind of interested in it," and then, offhandedly said, "If British Columbians care, email me," and, people started a spontaneous letter-writing campaign to the premier. Not a big one, but enough that I think he took it a little bit more seriously, but they're still kind of backburnering it, also looking to say, well, if the rest of the West Coast doesn't change, why would we change? But now that looks to be changing.
Yes. However, time is a federal responsibility in the United States. So if the three western or coastal states that comprise the Pacific Zone decide that they all want to change, they still have to ask for approval of the Trump government. And seeing as how Trump is a spiteful asshole who wants nothing good, it doesn't seem like that would be something that he would do.
And he would hate all the hippies on the coast?
Yeah, I don't know. It's
sometimes the uncontroversial things or the, like, not partisan things can sneak through, like, the bureaucrat underling.
I don't know who actually would be in charge of this in the States. Here, however, time is a provincial responsibility, and so we can just change the Interpretation Act, and it will change time in BC. So, like, I personally am in favor of it. It's like one of those things where it's like coinage reform. There's literally no good reason to be against it, but there's no
urgency.
Strong urgency, and there's no, like, reason for anyone to expend political capital on it, even though it would just help everyone.
I do credit Stephen Harper for killing the penny.
Yeah.
That was a good thing. No one misses it.
No. No, they don't.
At me. Where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Naylor4X, where I do no tweeting at all.
Actually, you've been a little bit busier this last week.
I've been a little bit busier. I've been told that I should tweet more. And so
I've been told I should tweet less, so.
People can also find me by emailing cambyreport@gmail.com, or if you are accused of a crime, phoning the Sarah Lehman Law Corporation at 900-9211. That's 604-900-9211. Especially driving infractions. Remember, always contest your traffic tickets. Oh, and of course, Spirits of the Law, which that firm produces.
And the Cambie Report, which we should have another episode coming up next week.
Yep. We're going to be talking about some environmental legislation, regulation, motion, whatever.
Whatever the city does.
Yeah. Stuff. Law. Municipal law.
Yeah. That's been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe. Let us know what you think.
If you're a first-time listener, sorry.
It's been great. Support the show. Get access to our exclusive Slack channel, unless you're Matthew, where it keeps rejecting you.
I don't know why. I keep trying.
Patreon.com/politicoast. The intro music for the show is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikov. Thank you for listening.
Good night.